A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He was walking and saw someone passed out on the sidewalk. Before he could even figure out what to do, someone else was already trying to rouse the guy, and within a minute the whole thing was resolved. His question is about what was actually happening in that minute. How do bystanders implicitly divide up tasks in an emergency, especially in a place like Israel where everyone runs toward the person in trouble? And what are the actual best practices for collaboration when you've got too many first responders and no clear chain of command?
This is one of those questions where the answer is both simpler and more interesting than people expect. The formal term for what Daniel witnessed is emergent coordination. It's been studied extensively in disaster sociology. Enrico Quarantelli at the University of Delaware basically founded this field. He documented how strangers at disaster scenes self-organize into functional teams within seconds to minutes, without anyone formally designating a leader.
The chaos sorts itself.
It sorts itself, but with an asterisk. The sorting works better when there are shared cultural scripts. And Israel is actually a fascinating case study for this, because you've got a population where a huge percentage of people have some form of emergency training. Military service, Magen David Adam, volunteer stints, the whole Rofe Bakirum first responder app network. Everyone's got a mental model.
Which explains the everyone runs toward the problem thing.
But that's also the trap. When too many people with some training show up, you get what emergency physicians call skill dilution. Everyone assumes someone else is doing the critical thing, or worse, three people try to do the same critical thing simultaneously.
Like three people all checking for a pulse at once.
Which happens constantly. I've seen it. You get a cluster of people around one arm while the airway is completely unmanaged. The Israeli emergency medicine community actually has a term for this. They call it Hatzalah Havratit, social rescue, where the social dynamics of helping can interfere with the helping itself.
Let's get concrete. Someone's down on the sidewalk. You're one of five people who stopped. What's the actual sequence that should happen?
The standard framework, and this comes from the American Heart Association's guidelines but has been adopted globally, is that the first person to reach the patient takes what's called the clinical lead. That person does the primary assessment, responsiveness, airway, breathing, circulation. And here's the part most people miss. The clinical lead is supposed to verbalize everything they're finding, out loud.
Why out loud?
Because it creates a shared mental model for everyone standing there. If I say unresponsive, breathing normally, no visible bleeding, everyone now knows the same three facts. That's the coordination foundation. It also signals competence, which makes other people more willing to take direction from you.
Even if you're not actually the most qualified person there.
That's the uncomfortable truth. The person who speaks first and sounds like they know what they're doing often becomes the de facto leader, regardless of actual qualifications. But the guidelines account for this. They emphasize that leadership can and should transfer if someone more qualified arrives. The script is literally, I have more training, may I take over, and the first person hands off.
Which requires the first person to not have an ego about it.
And that's where Israeli culture gets interesting. You mentioned the crude quality Daniel referenced. There's actually a paper from Ben-Gurion University's Emergency Medicine Department published around 2023 that studied this exact dynamic. They found that in Israeli emergency scenes, the informal leadership handoff happens faster than in most other cultures they studied, partly because Israelis are less polite about it.
Less polite meaning move, I know what I'm doing. Actually get said out loud.
The study found that the median time from first responder arrival to clear leadership designation was about 11 seconds in Israeli urban settings compared to something like 45 seconds in comparable European settings where people are more hesitant to assert themselves.
That's wild!
But the flip side is that the Israeli scenes also had a higher rate of what they called conflicting directives, two people giving contradictory orders simultaneously. The politeness filter is gone, but so is the coordination filter.
You need the assertiveness without the chaos. What's the actual mechanism?
There's a framework called the Zero Responder Protocol that's been gaining traction, particularly through the European Resuscitation Council. The idea is that before professional help arrives, the scene needs three roles filled and only three: clinical lead, communicator, and scene manager.
Break those down.
Clinical lead is doing the hands-on assessment and intervention, checking responsiveness, doing CPR if needed, managing the airway. Communicator is the person on the phone with emergency services, and they have one job: relay exactly what the clinical lead says and follow dispatcher instructions. Scene manager handles everything else: clearing space, directing traffic if needed, gathering information from bystanders, meeting the ambulance.
Three distinct roles. And the problem Daniel described is that you might have eight people with CPR training all trying to do the clinical lead role simultaneously.
Because it's the most visible and feels the most heroic. Nobody wants to be the person who just stands there holding a phone. But the communicator role is arguably more important in the first 2 minutes, because that's how you get an AED dispatched and an ambulance rolling with accurate information.
The tip is, if you arrive and someone's already doing the hands-on stuff, default to communicator or scene manager.
Say it out loud. I'm calling emergency services now. I'm going to clear the sidewalk. That verbalization is what prevents the four people checking a pulse problem.
The verbalization thing keeps coming up. It's almost like the entire coordination system runs on people narrating what they're doing.
That's exactly what it runs on. There's a concept from aviation called crew resource management that emergency medicine borrowed heavily. The core principle is that teams function when information is shared explicitly, not assumed. In a cockpit, the pilot doesn't just flip a switch. They say, turning on the fuel pump. Same principle applies on a sidewalk.
Because the stakes are high and the team is ad hoc.
Because silence breeds assumption, and assumption breeds error. I read a case study from the UK's Resuscitation Council where a cardiac arrest scene had 7 medically trained bystanders: 2 doctors, a nurse, a paramedic student, 3 first aiders, and for the first 90 seconds, nobody did CPR because everyone assumed someone else was about to.
7 qualified people watching a man die because they were all too qualified to act.
It's called the bystander effect, but the more specific mechanism here is diffusion of responsibility. The more people present, the less any individual feels personally responsible. The antidote is explicit role assignment within the first 10 seconds. Point at someone and say, "You, call emergency services." Point at someone else and say, "You, find an AED." Pointing is remarkably effective. There's research on this. If you make eye contact and point at a specific person, the compliance rate is something like 94%. If you just shout, "Someone call 911," into a crowd, the compliance rate drops to around 40%.
Because someone means not me specifically.
The specificity of the request is everything. And this is where the Israeli cultural dynamic cuts both ways. Israelis are very willing to jump in, but they're also very willing to ignore someone who isn't being specific, because everyone thinks they know best.
The actual skill isn't medical knowledge. It's the willingness to point at strangers and give orders.
That's deeply uncomfortable for most people. The literature calls it command reluctance. Even trained professionals experience it in civilian settings. You're breaking social norms. You're being bossy in public, to strangers, in a high-stakes situation where you might be wrong.
If you're wrong, you're the person who told everyone to do the wrong thing while someone died.
That's the fear. But the protocols are designed to be error-tolerant. The dispatcher on the phone is a check on the clinical lead's assessment. The scene manager is a check on the environment. The system has redundancy built in.
Let's go back to Daniel's specific scenario. Someone's sleeping on the sidewalk, or appears to be. That's a different problem than a cardiac arrest where you know something's wrong.
And this is where I think the most useful framework is something called the graded response. You don't jump straight to full emergency protocol. The first step is what Daniel described. Someone tried to rouse the person verbally. That's correct. You approach, you speak loudly, you observe.
If they're just sleeping.
Then the situation de-escalates. But here's the thing. You still want to do a quick assessment before you walk away. Is the breathing pattern normal? Is there any sign of injury? Is the person in a safe position? The recovery position isn't just for unconscious people. If someone's sleeping on a sidewalk in a position where they could aspirate, moving them onto their side is a low-effort, high-impact intervention.
Even the just sleeping scenario has a checklist.
A 30-second checklist. And if you're the second or third bystander arriving, your role at this stage is not to crowd the person doing the assessment. Stand back. Look for hazards. Be ready to make the call if the assessment turns up something concerning.
This is the implicit coordination Daniel was asking about. Nobody assigned roles, but roles emerged.
Because the situation was low acuity. In a low acuity situation, someone might be sleeping, might be intoxicated, might be having a medical issue, but isn't in immediate danger. The natural human tendency is to let the closest person take the lead and for others to hang back as backup. The problem is when the situation escalates and that backup role needs to convert to an active role instantly.
That conversion is where it breaks.
Because the backup people haven't been mentally rehearsing. They've been spectators. And going from spectator to participant takes a cognitive shift that, under stress, can take several seconds, which is a long time if someone's not breathing.
What should the backup people be doing mentally during that low acuity assessment phase?
Running their own parallel assessment. Where's the nearest AED? What's the exact address I'd give emergency services? Is there traffic I need to manage? Who else is here, and what do they seem capable of? It's what the military calls situational awareness maintenance. You're not the actor, but you're keeping a running mental model of the scene so you can step in without a warm-up period.
This is starting to sound like a skill that could be taught in an hour.
It absolutely could. And some organizations are starting to do exactly this. The British Heart Foundation launched a program called Everyday Heroes that specifically teaches non-medical bystander coordination, how to be an effective second or third person at an emergency scene. It's not CPR training, it's coordination training.
Which is arguably the missing piece. Everyone teaches CPR, nobody teaches how to not make the scene worse when three people already know CPR.
There's a paper from Resuscitation Journal, published early 2025, that looked at exactly this gap. They analyzed over 200 out-of-hospital cardiac arrest videos, public CCTV footage, and coded the bystander behaviors. The single biggest predictor of effective resuscitation wasn't the number of trained bystanders or even the quality of CPR. It was whether someone took on a coordination role within the first 30 seconds.
Not skill, coordination.
Skill matters, but coordination multiplies skill. Two people doing mediocre CPR with good coordination have better outcomes than four experts in chaos. The paper found a 40% higher survival to hospital discharge rate in coordinated scenes versus chaotic ones, controlling for everything else.
40% is enormous.
It's the difference between a system that works and a system that doesn't, and the coordination role doesn't require medical training. It requires exactly what we've been describing, the willingness to verbalize, assign roles, and maintain the shared mental model.
Let's talk about the Israeli angle specifically, because Daniel raised it and it's genuinely interesting. The everyone runs toward the person culture.
Israel has something called the Magen David Adam First Responder Network. It's a smartphone app that alerts trained volunteers when an emergency is happening within 500 meters of them. There are over 25,000 registered volunteers. In urban areas, the median response time for a first responder to arrive on scene is under 3 minutes, often under 90 seconds.
That's faster than the ambulance in many cases.
Ambulance median response in Tel Aviv is around 8 to 10 minutes. So you've got this gap where trained volunteers are arriving in 90 seconds, but the professional team is 8 minutes out. That gap is where all the coordination challenges live.
You've got multiple volunteers arriving simultaneously.
Sometimes 5 or 6 at a single scene. MDA actually had to develop protocols specifically for this, what they call multi-responder scene management. The app now includes a feature where the first volunteer to arrive can claim the scene, and subsequent arrivals see that the scene is claimed and are prompted to take support roles.
That's the digital version of pointing at someone and saying, "You, call emergency services."
It's exactly that, systematized. And they've published data showing it reduced conflicting interventions by about 30%.
What happens when you don't have an app? When you're just a random bystander in a crowd of random bystanders?
Then you fall back on what emergency physicians call the loudest voice in the room protocol. It's not elegant, but it's what we've got. Someone needs to speak up clearly with specific directives. And here's the thing that first aid courses often get wrong. They teach that the most trained person should take charge. But in practice, you can't determine who's most trained. You can determine who's willing to speak.
The advice should be, If you're willing to coordinate, coordinate. Don't wait for someone more qualified.
Because the cost of waiting is higher than the cost of imperfect coordination. The worst-case scenario isn't that someone with basic training gives imperfect directions. The worst-case scenario is that nobody gives any directions.
That's a framing that might actually reduce the command reluctance you mentioned. Reframe it as, your imperfect leadership is better than perfect silence.
There's a concept from decision theory called satisficing. It means accepting an adequate solution rather than waiting for the optimal one. Emergency scenes are the ultimate satisficing environment. You're not looking for the best possible leader. You're looking for any leader who meets the minimum threshold of being willing and not completely clueless.
The minimum threshold is actually pretty low. Can you speak clearly? Can you point at people? Can you remember three roles?
That's basically it. The clinical lead needs more training, but the coordinator just needs those three things.
Let's talk about the transition moment, when professional help arrives. That's another point where scenes fall apart.
Oh, this is a huge problem. Paramedics arrive and the bystanders don't know how to hand off. They either keep doing what they're doing, forcing the paramedics to physically take over, or they all scatter instantly, leaving the paramedics with no information about what happened.
What's the correct handoff?
It's called SBAR, Situation, Background, Assessment, Recommendation. It's a structured communication tool from healthcare. The clinical lead or coordinator gives the paramedics a 30-second summary. This is what we found, this is what we think happened, this is what we've done, and here's what we think you should know.
30 seconds, four elements.
Then you step back and let them work. But you stay available if they have questions. The handoff is a structured transfer of responsibility, not an abandonment.
Daniel's scenario resolved itself in about a minute. The person was roused and moved away. But what if it hadn't? What if the person had been unresponsive?
Then the coordination becomes critical. Let me walk through what the ideal 60 seconds looks like based on current guidelines. 0 to 10 seconds, first person reaches the patient, checks responsiveness, verbalizes findings. 10 to 20 seconds, second person calls emergency services, puts the phone on speaker, positions themselves so the clinical lead can hear the dispatcher. 20 to 30 seconds, clinical lead checks breathing and pulse simultaneously. The guidelines now recommend checking both at once rather than sequentially, saves about 8 seconds. 30 to 45 seconds, if no normal breathing, clinical lead starts, CPR, while the communicator relays this to dispatch and a third person, if available, is sent to find an AED.
If there is normal breathing.
Then the clinical lead puts the person in the recovery position, and the communicator stays on the line with dispatch describing the situation. The scene manager, if there is one, starts gathering information from anyone who saw what happened.
This all assumes at least two people who know what they're doing.
It assumes at least one person who knows the framework. The second person doesn't need to know anything, they just need to follow instructions. The communicator role requires zero medical knowledge. The scene manager role requires zero medical knowledge. Only the clinical lead needs training, and even then, dispatcher-guided CPR is effective.
Dispatcher-guided CPR. That's where the emergency operator talks you through it in real time?
And the data on this is surprisingly good. A study from King's College London, published in 2024, found that dispatcher-guided CPR produced neurologically intact survival rates within about 5 percentage points of trained bystander CPR. The gap exists, but it's small. The much bigger gap is between any CPR and no CPR.
The communicator on speakerphone is basically importing expertise into the scene.
That's exactly the right way to think about it. The dispatcher becomes a remote team member. And this is why the communicator role is so important. It's not just about summoning help, it's about creating a channel for real-time expert guidance.
Which means the person on the phone shouldn't be the most trained person at the scene.
Correct. And this is a common mistake. The person with the most training should be doing clinical assessment, not holding the phone. But the instinct is often the opposite. The trained person wants to be the one talking to the professionals, because it feels more responsible.
When actually, they're just removing themselves from the role where their training matters most.
It's a resource allocation error. And it happens constantly. I saw a case once where an off-duty ICU nurse spent 5 minutes on the phone with dispatch describing the scene while two untrained bystanders did ineffective CPR. She was the most qualified person within a mile radius, and she was holding a phone.
The tip is, if you're trained, put yourself on the body. If you're untrained, put yourself on the phone.
If you're unsure, ask, is anyone here medically trained? If someone says yes, hand them the clinical roll and take the phone.
This is all very orderly, but Daniel's observation about Israeli culture suggests it often isn't orderly. You've got multiple people with military medic training, multiple MDA volunteers, and they're all used to being the person in charge.
This is the too many chiefs problem. And it's not unique to Israel. You see it in any population with high rates of emergency training, like military towns or communities with volunteer fire departments. The solution, and this is what MDA has been pushing in their public education campaigns, is what they call first on scene, first in charge. The first person to arrive and start the assessment is the clinical lead until professional help arrives, regardless of relative qualifications.
That's a norm, not a rule.
It's a norm that's being actively cultivated, and norms work when they're widely known. The first-on-scene norm is becoming as ingrained in Israeli emergency culture as Call 101, Magen David Adam's emergency number.
101, not 112.
Israel uses 101 for MDA ambulance, 100 for police, 102 for fire. They're all separate. It's a whole thing.
That seems like a coordination problem in itself.
It absolutely is, and there have been multiple efforts to unify them under 112, but the legacy systems are entrenched. Anyway, the point is that the first on scene norm is a cultural technology for managing the too many chiefs problem.
Cultural technology. I like that. A norm as a tool.
It is a tool. It's a coordination shortcut. Instead of negotiating leadership at every scene, you just default to whoever got there first. It's not perfect, but it's fast, and speed matters more than optimization in the first 2 minutes.
What about the explicit coordination Daniel asked about? The deliberate collaboration between strangers?
There's a protocol called closed-loop communication that's standard in resuscitation teams and is starting to filter into public first aid training. The idea is that when someone gives an instruction, the recipient repeats it back. Get the AED. Getting the AED, call 101. Calling 101.
There's no ambiguity about whether the message was received.
It creates a record of who's doing what. Everyone at the scene can hear that someone is getting the AED and someone else is calling emergency services. It prevents duplication and gaps simultaneously.
This is the verbalization principle again. The entire system is just people saying what they're doing out loud.
Because there's no other coordination infrastructure. In a hospital, you have roles, hierarchies, protocols, training, physical infrastructure. On a sidewalk, you have none of that. The only coordination tool available is speech. So the protocols are all built around maximizing the information density of speech.
What about nonverbal coordination? Daniel mentioned that, in his situation, roles emerged implicitly. Someone approached the person, he noted the location, someone else roused them. Nobody said, I'll take the clinical lead.
In low acuity, short duration situations, implicit coordination works fine because the stakes are low and the task is simple. The problem is that implicit coordination doesn't scale to complexity or urgency. If the person had been unresponsive and not breathing, the implicit approach would have failed. You'd have had a chaotic scramble.
The skill is recognizing when to switch from implicit to explicit.
The trigger is simple. If the initial assessment reveals anything concerning, unresponsiveness, abnormal breathing, visible injury, confusion, you switch to explicit immediately. Verbalize what you're seeing, assign roles, make eye contact.
The eye contact thing is interesting. Why does it matter?
Eye contact creates a temporary social bond that overrides the stranger default of non-engagement. There's neurobiological research on this. Direct eye contact activates the prefrontal cortex and amygdala in ways that increase social attention and compliance. It's a hardwired human thing.
Pointing plus eye contact is basically a neurological hack for emergency coordination.
That's exactly what it is. And it works across cultures, across language barriers, across age groups. A 90-year-old grandmother and a 20-year-old backpacker who don't share a language can coordinate an emergency response through pointing, eye contact, and tone of voice.
That's actually reassuring. The basic tools are universal.
The protocols are just structured versions of things humans naturally do when they're not inhibited by social anxiety. The training is mostly about removing the inhibition, not teaching new skills.
Let's talk about the inhibition. Why are people uncomfortable taking charge?
Fear of being wrong. Fear of looking foolish. Fear of legal liability, which is mostly unfounded, by the way. Good Samaritan laws in most jurisdictions protect bystanders who act in good faith. The social cost of being bossy. And then there's what psychologists call evaluation apprehension. The fear of being judged by others at the scene.
The fear of being the person who shouted orders while someone died.
Which is the worst case scenario in people's minds. But the actual worst case scenario, statistically, is that nobody shouted anything and someone died who could have been saved. The data is overwhelmingly clear on this.
Is there any evidence that training specifically addresses this psychological barrier?
There's a Norwegian study from 2024 that tested an intervention where first aid trainees practiced scene leadership as a specific skill, separate from medical skills. They had to walk into a simulated emergency and start giving orders to strangers. The training reduced command reluctance by about 60% measured by response time to first directive.
60% is massive. Why isn't this standard everywhere?
Because first aid training is still organized around the model of a single rescuer with a single victim. The curriculum was designed in the 1960s and has been remarkably resistant to change. The multi-bystander scenario, which is actually the most common real-world scenario, is barely addressed in most standard courses.
The training assumes you're alone with the victim, but in reality, you're in a crowd.
The crowd is both the problem and the solution. If you can coordinate the crowd, you've multiplied your effectiveness. If you can't, you've got chaos.
What about the specific resources question Daniel asked? How do you figure out who has the most recent training when you can't run a survey?
You don't. That's the honest answer. You can't determine relative qualifications in 10 seconds. What you can do is ask one question. Does anyone have medical training? If one person raises their hand, they're your clinical lead. If multiple people raise their hands, you go with whoever's closest or whoever spoke first. If nobody raises their hand, you're the clinical lead or you're guiding someone else through it with dispatcher support.
The whoever spoke first heuristic again.
It's not fair, but it's fast. And speed is the overriding priority in the first minute. Once the scene is stabilized, you can transfer roles if needed.
What about equipment? Daniel mentioned resources. How do you know if there's an AED nearby?
There are apps for this. Pulse Point is the big one in the US. It shows AED locations and alerts trained responders. In Israel, the MDA app has an AED locator. But if you don't have the app, you ask the dispatcher. They have AED registries and can direct you. And if there's no AED and no app and the dispatcher doesn't know, you send someone to the nearest public building, gym, school, community center, large office, and have them ask.
Because most public buildings have them now.
In Israel, AEDs have been mandatory in public buildings since 2018. In the US, it varies by state, but penetration is high in urban areas. The bigger problem is that people don't know where they are. Studies show that even people who work in buildings with AEDs often can't locate them.
Part of bystander readiness is just noticing where the AED is in places you frequent.
It's the lowest effort, highest potential impact thing you can do. Spend 30 seconds noting the AED location next time you're at the gym or the grocery store. That knowledge could save someone 6 minutes of searching.
6 minutes is the difference between survival and brain death and cardiac arrest.
For every minute without CPR and defibrillation, survival probability drops by about 10%. After 10 minutes, you're approaching zero. So knowing where the AED is, or having someone who can find it fast, is literally life and death.
Let's circle back to Daniel's specific scenario and the informal triage he mentioned. What's the difference between informal triage and just chaos?
Triage implies a systematic prioritization. Informal triage means that prioritization is happening without an explicit framework. In Daniel's scene, the prioritization was correct. Someone checked on the person, someone noted the location, someone else tried to rouse them. Those are the right tasks in the right order. The question is whether that prioritization would hold if the situation were more serious.
The answer is probably not without someone explicitly managing it.
Which brings us back to the core recommendation. If you're in a multi-bystander emergency, the single most valuable thing you can do, regardless of your training level, is to take the coordination role. Not the clinical role, the coordination role. Verbalize what's happening, assign tasks to specific people, maintain the shared mental model.
If someone else is already doing that, support them.
By taking one of the other roles explicitly. I've got the phone. I'm clearing the path for the ambulance. I'm going to look for an AED. Say it out loud so the coordinator knows that role is filled.
It's remarkable how much of this comes down to just talking.
Emergency scenes are information processing problems before they're medical problems. Until you know what's happening and who's doing what, you can't deliver effective care. The talking is the infrastructure.
The advice for Daniel, if he finds himself in that situation again, which, living in Jerusalem, he probably will, is be the person who says things out loud.
Don't wait for permission. The permission is the emergency itself.
There's something almost philosophical here. The emergency suspends normal social rules. You're allowed to be direct, to point, to give orders, to take charge. The inhibition is self-imposed.
The training, ideally, is just giving you permission in advance. A pre-authorization to be bossy when it matters.
Permission to be bossy. That's a good way to frame it.
I think so. Most people already have the instincts. They just need the green light.
What's the one thing you'd want every listener to take away from this?
If you do nothing else, do this. If you see an emergency and other people are already helping, don't walk away and don't just stand there. Walk up and say, I'm here, what do you need? That one sentence, I'm here, what do you need, is a complete coordination intervention. It signals availability, it defers to whoever is already leading, and it doesn't require any training. 5 words that can turn a chaotic scene into a team. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1930s, physicist Saishi Kikuchi at Osaka Imperial University... Wait, that's Honshu, not Hokkaido. Let me reframe. In the 1930s, Japanese physicists studying cosmic rays on Mount Asahi in Hokkaido used a cloud chamber wrapped in lead shielding to filter out lower energy particles. They measured muon flux at altitude and found it was roughly 3 times higher than at sea level, a key early confirmation that cosmic ray particles decay in flight. Modern muon detectors at the same site now measure the same flux with about 10,000 times the sensitivity.
10,000 times the sensitivity. We've gotten better at counting things that are already dead by the time they reach us.
That's the whole show, really.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for the fact and for keeping the cosmic rays counted. If you want more episodes like this one, find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.